Welcome to the Wounds That Do Not Heal. My name is Tressa Brady. After my own experience and hearing time and time again about domestic violence in military families, I decided to start this podcast. Tune in for stories, resources, and guidance on how to get the support you need for your family and your safety. They say that all wounds heal in time, but it's not true. There are some wounds that a lifetime of waiting couldn't heal. And I'm not talking about broken bones or the stitches on your knee from when you fell off a bike as a kid. I'm talking about the wounds that you can't see. More specifically, the invisible wounds of war. Now you can try to compartmentalize this pain, bury it, move past it. But unfortunately, sometimes a broken leg heals much faster than a broken heart. And you can't put a Band-Aid on your emotional trauma. And sadly, if left untreated, these traumas can manifest into much darker, much more insidious repercussions. Anger, rage, suicidal ideation, and yes, sometimes even homicide. Now, I've never had boots on the ground in Kandahar or been hit with shrapnel while on patrol in Fallujah. I haven't been given orders to go replace my best friend, who was just killed in action by an insurgent that he was training in the Afghan Army Partner Force. I haven't had to make critical, split-second decisions about what to do when coming face-to-face with a child soldier who has a weapon. I've actually read that the Taliban will place kids as young as 6 out there to plant IEDs. Never had to survive any of that. And I can't imagine just being expected to return home back to normalcy, falling right back into the role of husband, father, son, all the while knowing that you have team members back in combat fighting for their lives and other friends who may be sitting in a box with an American flag on it at the airline's cargo facility, waiting to be transferred to a hearse. I've never done any of that, but I have tried to love somebody through it. And I have fought in my own war at home. And I have real battle scars, the kind you don't see. I was even given a PTSD diagnosis of my own. Because like many military wives to a special forces soldier, I too became collateral damage to a war that I wasn't technically fighting in. But you won't hear that. Because as a good combat wife, you're expected to suffer in silence. Nobody has the bandwidth to deal with your woes when we're talking about the loss of life and limb for the soldiers, and nobody wants you to badmouth them. As I've gotten older and wiser, there's a few certainties that I've come to realize. We don't speak ill of the dead. We don't make fun of disabled people. You never bring kids into it. You know, when you see these keyboard warriors on social media and they're tearing down celebrities or whoever, and someone mentions someone's child, and everyone goes, whoa, whoa, too far. We don't bring kids into it. You don't talk shit about Britney Spears, and you don't badmouth the people who sworn to protect and serve us. But what happens when the villain in your story is the hero and everyone else's? When the people you go to for help your abuser? I'm here because I'm the survivor of abuse at the hands of a highly decorated Special Forces soldier. I successfully left that man over 10 years ago and have been happily married to my forever husband for some time. But I have never stopped looking over my shoulder, fearing what my ex may do to me, or more specifically, what he may do to other women. My ultimate hope has been that by leaving him, it would cause him to hit rock bottom and finally go seek the help he needs. But now that I've become very, very good friends with his wife, or sorry, his second ex-wife, I found out that my worst fear actually came true. He never got help, and he got so much worse and so much more violent. His life now is filled with chaos and 911 calls and court cases, and I'm not here because I have an axe to grind with him. I'm here because I hope to help other soldiers from becoming like him and other wives like me from losing their battles. I'm going to be referring to my ex-husband as Chris and his second ex-wife as Faith. That's not their real names. And I really hope people don't dox him because I do fear for repercussions to Faith. And that's not her real name. She's going to come on the show and she can decide if she wants to give her identity. But I'm calling her Faith because I've never seen someone be dragged through the depths of hell from abuse and further abuse from family court who seems hell-bent on protecting abusers and come out the other side of it and still be one of the sweetest, most positive, kindest humans. She's incredibly resilient. When you become a military wife, specifically of a combat soldier, you do so with a loose understanding that you're committing to a very non-traditional life. Maybe you've accepted the fact that you will make many sacrifices to your own needs and wants and concessions. You know that there's going to be months of the year where you're living without your partner, when compiled together, maybe even years apart. You may realize that you're going to be moved around the country, not necessarily to anywhere you want to go and not near friends or family. You may realize you're going to be doing a significant amount of solo parenting, despite the fact that you are not a single parent. But what you may not realize is that even though you didn't sign the dotted line to join the military, when you married your spouse, you essentially became their property, so long as you want to stay with him. They will have license over every major decision in your life. And they don't necessarily have to take your preferences into consideration. Like that job that you've worked so hard to get, that you need to stay locally for, they'll still PCS you. And if you're pregnant and your husband's deployed, they won't necessarily get him home in time to see the birth of his child. You may be having fertility struggles and going down that road alone. Or you may have just had a miscarriage and they deploy your husband. And if you're really lucky, your husband may be a part of a unit where they really try to get him back, but they don't have to. The military is all about the greater good. They cannot take the feelings of their soldiers and certainly not the feelings of their spouses into consideration. It's all about the greater good when it comes to war. Individuals, unfortunately, just can't matter. But despite knowing all of this, there's still a great deal of honor in marrying into the military. And you feel a real sense of pride, especially marrying a combat soldier, knowing that you've married someone among the bravest men in the world. Those who raise their hand to put on America's jersey and jump out of planes into enemy territory, they run into burning buildings with some of the world's scariest terrorists. So there's definitely an honor, but there's also an unspoken oath to do no harm to your husband's career. And what I mean by that is you may realize that your husband is not adjusting well from his return after combat. He may also be very abusive and you feel unsafe, but you're expected to hold this secret, even if it's to your own detriment or his own safety as well. While you may want to just get him help, in doing so, you could actually jeopardize his career. If labeled with a mental health diagnosis, a soldier could lose their jobs. So many soldiers come home and they realize that they have post-traumatic stress, but they also feel handcuffed in trying to seek out treatment. They suffer, and their wives and their children suffer, and then they redeploy. And they get worse and worse until less and less of your husband returns home each deployment. And left in his place is just an empty shell of an angry, rageful stranger that you don't recognize. Now, I'm obviously referring quite a bit to post-traumatic stress disorder, and you may have heard of it, but maybe you're not totally familiar with what it is. So, what is it? During the Civil War, before anyone knew better, doctors started to recognize in soldiers a lot of signs and symptoms that were believed to be cardiac or even stress, effort, or exertion related. They thought that the fatigue, the chest palpitations, the shortness of breath, exhaustion, insomnia, all of those things were chalked up to this irritable heart syndrome. But when more and more soldiers were coming up with it, they realized that it was actually tied to a lot of psychiatric issues as well. In today's day and age, those cardiac symptoms often indicate POTS syndrome, which is a problem in the autonomic nervous system, which is the body's unconscious control system and change of heart and body functions. So it makes sense that seeing that, a doctor may think it was cardiac. But in fact, it ended up being more psychiatric. And they referred to the condition as soldier's heart, which I actually think is very fitting for an ailment that one suffers after being subjected to massive amounts of trauma that has left them with a, for lack of a better term, broken heart. One interesting thing of note that I discovered when I was digging into what is PTSD and how war causes it, I was actually really surprised to find out that it isn't necessarily the death and the violence or the bombs and gunfire that can often affect military members. It actually affects military members who don't see combat almost as much as combat soldiers. So around 85% of this nation's armed forces is comprised of support roles, all equally important, but that means they support about 15% of combat soldiers. But many people who don't see combat will come home and experience post-traumatic stress disorder. There's actually a really good book I'm reading. It is called Tribe. It is by Sebastian Junger. It's a soft J. Anyways, very good book. I actually think a lot of soldiers would enjoy reading this. I think the wives will really benefit from reading this as well, and maybe understanding why when your husband comes home from war, he almost seems like he misses it. That was hard for me. My ex-husband would stay up all night playing Call of Duty and these combat war games and just drink a fifth of Jameson. And it was like he was longing to get home. While he was deployed, he was saying he was miserable and he hated being downrange. He just wanted to be home. And then when he was home, it was as if he missed it. Well, in this book, Sebastian Junger, he describes the struggle for soldiers to reintegrate into society. So they really struggle with coming back and relating to civilians or how civilians relate to them. He also discusses this phenomenon of how disasters can actually unite people. So think about, for example, some disaster in history, like 9/11. Let's think about 9/11. 9/11 will forever be burned into my brain as one of the saddest days I've ever lived in my life. I remember I was a sophomore in college and one of my roommates came running in and said, they've hit the towers. They've hit the Twin Towers. Turn on the TV. I was so out of sorts. I was living in Northern California and I had no idea what they were talking about. And we turn on the TV and you see that first plane hit and it's like, oh my gosh, like how did that happen? Did the pilot have a medical episode? What's going on? And then you see the second plane hit and it occurs, like your mind realizes this is intentional. We're under attack. And it was just devastating to realize that other humans were doing this, were choosing to do this, the depravity of it all. It was just life-changing. And I'll never forget how sad that day was. And then the next day, 9/12, it was amazing. The tragedy united the nation and you saw strangers helping strangers and we saw American flags flying high and people in the streets cheering each other on. And it truly brought out the best in people. And that's kind of like, I think after natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina as well, you can focus on the sadness or you can look to the helpers. And when you look at the helpers, you really feel that sense of unity that people feel when they're all banded together in a common cause, even if brought together by tragedy. And that's kind of how this book, Tribe, talks about tragedy. It's that people are united by it. And so often when soldiers come home, they're isolated. They may have their family, but they no longer have that group that's united in a common cause. And it causes this sense of loss and sadness. And it's not the danger that they miss, but the unity from being endangered together. I've actually read that a lot of military members who end up dying by suicide are those who retire or even younger soldiers who weren't even necessarily combat soldiers, but they did their 4 years or whatever and they get out. That transition timeframe for all soldiers, whatever their job, is really dangerous because they're used to having a common goal. A person telling them where to go, what to do, what time to show up, what you're going to eat, how to exercise. And the second they lose that purpose, some of them can tailspin into a lost identity and they lose hope. And that is why it is so important. And I'm seeing it more prevalent now, especially on like LinkedIn, where businesses are recognizing this and really trying to help soldiers transition from military life to civilian life. And they're looking at the value of their transactional skills. And it's not just now that they can work in security or these civilian jobs that are like their military job. They're finding ways to apply those skills that they had in the military out into the business world, which I think is fantastic. But I would like for more people to think about the wives and what they can do in their transitions. So you may be wondering, on another note, if there's treatment for PTSD. And the answer is yes, unequivocally, yes. I'm so excited to dive into all those because there are some really great cutting-edge therapies that are showing a lot of promise. And we'll go over all that. But until soldiers can freely go get treatment without fear of the stigma of a mental health diagnosis or a threat to their career trajectory, many will continue to try to cope with PTSD on their own. The thing is, though, this isn't something that most people can just fix themselves. While this may be an invisible ailment, it's a very real condition. In fact, brain scans in those suffering from this condition actually show that regions of the brain are altered, and it affects the neural circuit that mediates, among other functions, the ability of the body to adapt to stress and to fear. A simple Google search of PTSD in soldiers will show you that the military has tons and tons of programs in place to help those that are struggling with post-combat mental health challenges. They also have several programs in place to combat and address intimate partner abuse in the military. Now, as a side note, we'll dive more into what partner abuse can entail, but I like to use the word partner abuse more than domestic violence because people seem to believe that only physical abuse is domestic violence when it can entail so many other forms of abuse, but that's for next episode. So in the early 2000s, the military actually established a domestic violence or intimate partner abuse task force within the Department of Defense because they realized there was such a high prevalence of partner abuse in the military. The task force came up with tons of recommendations, including danger assessment tools, and they were going to provide resources to military spouses and education surrounding the unique circumstances of military life that kind of lend itself to enable domestic abuse. However, it was 2001 and coming to fruition at the exact time the war on terror was breaking out. What that meant was addressing the domestic violence incidences in the military fell to the very bottom of the priority list, while the number of service members who began to return from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD began to escalate. So, naturally, the outcome was even more domestic partner abuse. It was exacerbated, and partner abuse and child abuse, it all increased. So yes, there are many programs in the military for PTSD and to help with partner abuse. But like I said, until soldiers can freely get that help without mental health labels or repercussions to their career, a very small portion of armed forces members will raise their hand for help. It needs to be mandatory upon entering the military and part of their job to continue that therapy, and it needs to be continued for them long after their career is over and into retirement. It's the least this country can offer the brave men and women who raise their hands to protect this country. Right now, if a service member is diagnosed with a mental health condition, they can face being medically boarded or discharged from the military. When we look at special forces and specifically combat soldiers, there's also a lot of other factors to consider. These guys have to carry a firearm to do their job, and they also need top secret security clearance, which, if they're given a mental health diagnosis, they'll lose both of those things. Also, remember we're talking about a group of men who are the toughest in the world. Asking for help is very often unlikely. They're in a career field where they're trained that what they think and what they feel doesn't matter. It's the greater good and the needs of the team. The fact of the matter is, nobody wins with wars. But wars have been happening since the dawn of time, and sadly, they will likely continue long after we're buried and gone and generations from now. And along that same vein, there have been several studies about generational trauma from war that shows that war has a haunting legacy that can span for generations. It sometimes trickles down to generations so far removed from the person who went to war that those who went to war and have the trauma never actually interacted in real life. I'll link the studies in my show notes, but I wanted to kind of share the pearls that I gathered from the studies. So the group that was studied the most was those that survived World War II and Holocaust survivors. And it showed that the effects of trauma can get passed down a family's lineage of subsequent generations who never had direct exposure, like I just said. And that only makes sense, right? That our parents' behavior would mold and shape ours and then our children's. And we've all heard that sons of abusers have a good chance of becoming abusers and that daughters of abusers may seek out men who abuse them. But why? Essentially, what I've gathered from these studies is that the style of attachment that parents show when they're depressed can affect their ability to teach children how to regulate their own emotions. So the children may not be able to self-soothe, and they'll have a lot more cortisol production from living under a life that is so stressful. And that can also increase the occurrence of viral illnesses and even autoimmune diseases. So what we have is a recipe of long-term health problems and wellness issues. PTSD, or a post-traumatic stress injury, is a very real condition that needs to be addressed and treated. And then you've got to think of another layer of trauma for those who enter into the military who already have childhood trauma. Like my ex, Chris, he had a life that was just one trauma after the next. He was raised in a very traumatic setting with alcoholic parents who were violent, and he wanted to leave his one stoplight town. And so he joined the military to get away from it all, which is incredibly admirable. But now we're talking about somebody with probably already post-traumatic stress and some violent tendencies and some anger and some rage. And we're going to take it and culminate all of those attributes and make them worse, which might make for a really amazing combat soldier, but that doesn't translate so well into a marriage or children. I think everyone who enters into war or has a family member that goes off to war knows that there's a potential that their soldier will be lost. However, what a lot of people don't realize is that they actually weigh out an expected amount of loss and project the amount of inevitably lost innocent lives when countries go to war. Civilian casualties have happened in every war, and there are war rules in place to prevent war crimes, such as targeting citizens or even hospitals, but there are always caveats to that. So the United States military actually has a collateral damage estimator. What that means is they'll come up with a number of deaths or a human cost that they consider the collateral of the attack or the war. And that way they can proceed knowing that that amount of loss or those innocent lives are inevitable. From what I understand, the allowable number can actually go up the more dangerous the target. So let's say you have Osama bin Laden camped out next to a daycare. It may no longer be a war crime to take out that daycare. And that's so subjective, right? Because to me, that would never be okay. But if you're the military and you're trying to eradicate terrorism, you may commit genocide in the name of doing so. The fact of the matter is, in every war, innocent humans will die for the cause that don't even fight in the war. The cost of war is astronomical. And when you look at it from a macro level or a scope that is way zoomed out, where we understand that lives will be taken and full regions will be demolished, nations will have to rebuild. And we know that going into war. But then when you zoom down on the micro level and you take a really granular look at each soldier and their family and the impact on their marriage and their children, the repercussions of war are unconscionable. There will be inevitable losses and ripple effects that go on for generations, like I mentioned earlier. But it's not just lost lives. It's the trauma. You may have heard the reference to 22 a day. This is talked about and quite prevalent across social media and in discussions surrounding military veterans, because on every day average in the United States, 22 veterans will end their own lives. And there's been a call to action from military advocates to address the mental health of veterans, and specifically those veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan warrior groups. They seem to be the most at risk. So naturally, as a military advocate and supporter myself, I want to talk a lot about the mental health of soldiers. But one thing that's not being blasted across social media and highly emphasized by military advocates that I'm here to discuss is the mental health and well-being of the wives and children of those soldiers. These women are gravely affected, and many will go on to have secondhand PTSD. Many will be abused and suffer intimate partner violence. And sadly, some will be murdered by their partners. And I can't help but wonder if we're all just civilian casualties or auxiliary damage ourselves. Do they just add us into that collateral damage estimation that at the beginning? Is that why when a wife reports to the military, very often it's not escalated up the chain of command? The common theme that I hear over and over and over again when I talk to women is that they asked for help from the military and they did not get it. What that means is the soldiers that are abusing their wives are not only not getting punished, they're not getting help either. The brass or the soldiers' first shirt, family advocacy, whomever have been reported to, may have not escalated the report for one of many reasons. Perhaps they didn't believe the evidence supported that the service member in question committed abuse. Perhaps they didn't want to risk their soldier being taken off active duty. They didn't want to take a cog out of their machine, a very expensive weapon. I believe most likely it's to protect their service members from discipline or his career being in jeopardy. Maybe they can't afford to have anyone else on their team get in trouble or get taken out. But possibly, if they would have gotten that soldier in trouble, they would have gotten the help they need. Sure, maybe that soldier may have ended up with an Article 15. And for those of you that aren't familiar, an Article 15 is a non-judicial punishment that allows the chain of command to punish a soldier for offenses without formally charging them with a court-martial. So it won't go on their record. They won't have a criminal record. You don't get kicked out of the military. You can get demoted if you're like a lower-ranking soldier. By the way, I call everyone soldiers. I know that airmen is Air Force and Army is soldiers and Marine, and I know all those things. I also know that Space Force is Guardian, and I would like to maybe join one day. That sounds badass, but I'm going to be saying soldier, so bear with me. But anyways, you can get extra duties and restricted pay and some like slaps on the wrist, but you won't be kicked out of the military. So wouldn't it be better to punish soldiers to allow them to also get help and assess their mental health and require treatment than have them end up with dead wives? Some of the soldiers we're going to talk about on this show are literally in jail with a dead wife and orphan children. And I'm talking several cases. Several have murdered their spouses and then died by self-inflicted means. And in hindsight, I'm sure their families wish that they'd been punished and their mental health issues had been properly addressed and treated. We can all sit and hope that war will end and peace will come. And when that does, that these issues will just subside. But if you talk to those who are aware of what it's like in these areas of high conflict, it doesn't sound like peace is even an option. So I was actually listening to a Joe Rogan episode, and he was interviewing Dakota Meyer. If you're not familiar with Dakota, he is a Medal of Honor recipient. He's done a ton of heroic things. If you're an OG like me, he was Bristol Palin's husband on Teen Mom. They have two daughters together. And actually, I didn't like him on Teen Mom because I felt some of the way he talked to her and treated her and talked down about her was problematic. And I thought he might be abusive. In hindsight, it could have just been some PTSD signs that I saw that triggered me to my ex, and I could have been projecting, who knows. But since then, I followed him, you know, loosely on social media, and he has undergone a ton of treatment, and he's been very vocal about mental health options. He actually is how I found a treatment for PTSD and this treatment center with these new therapies. He spoke about it, and it led me to this psychologist that I've interviewed, and that's going to be at the end of this episode. So anyways, I've become a big fan. I really hope, it seems like he's doing a lot of wonderful things for the warrior community. So if you don't know Dakota, go follow him. But he was on Joe Rogan, and I'm going to paraphrase, I'm not quoting, but Joe Rogan essentially said, hey, Dakota, there's a lot of people in this country that don't think we should be nation building in other countries. But then people like Dan Crenshaw come on his show and say, well, you have to go over there because you can't let these groups get more powerful and gain more control. What are your thoughts? And then Dakota said, if not us, then who? America is a beacon of hope across the world. And when America is strong, we are hated. And when we are weak, the world suffers. We have an obligation to help people. He said, when Syria is gassing kids and women, if nobody is going to go over and help, I will gladly go and help. If not us, then who? It has nothing to do with anything other than good and evil. And if we don't go fight the evil, then the evil will grow and progress. And one of the interesting things he also said was, America going over there and fighting those terrorists over there gives them a place to fight us, that they want to fight us, and it keeps the fighting off American soil, which had never occurred to me before. And then the next part haunts me. Joe Rogan said, Dakota, do you think it's possible that this will all be resolved someday? And if it's not our children, then our children's children, do you think it's possible? And Dakota, without missing a beat, response, nope. If you look at any of the books that came before us, this is what you get. At any point in time, there's conflict going on. It will never be resolved. It will never be resolved. It will never be resolved. This is a maintenance program. that blew my mind, to think about this conflict that we've been over there since 2001, even sooner, still going on when my grandchildren's grandchildren are around, because it's never going to be resolved. It really hit me that there needs to be systemic changes within the military to proactively get these soldiers mental health therapy before, during, and after their careers. Since 2001, when we went over to this war on terror, 7,078 soldiers have been killed in battle. Since that time frame, over 32,000 war veterans, 32,000 have died by suicide, which means the after effects, the mental health after effects of war are far more lethal than the combat itself. Oof. So domestic violence is rampant in the military because of all of the reasons we've just listed. And while women will come forward and report it to the military, in my experience and in many of the ones I've witnessed and will be sharing, the military does not send these complaints up the chain of command. And more often than not, they do the opposite. They make a calculated decision to cover up the abuse, deny it, and essentially they foster an environment where domestic violence is not only tolerated or ignored, but it flourishes. I don't believe this to be the intent of the leaders who don't send the reports up their chain of command necessarily, but it's undeniably the outcome of their actions or their lack thereof. Their desire to keep their soldiers in the game has grave consequences. And sadly, their desire to keep their soldiers deployable and on active duty often signs the death certificate of the spouse and the soldier themselves. And after every murder or loss of a family member at the hands of a military soldier, I can count on one thing. There will always be a statement released by brass stating that there is a zero tolerance on domestic violence and that the military has taken active measures to prevent and identify domestic violence at the earliest occurrence of domestic violence. But we have an incredibly large gap between military leaders stating they are anti-domestic violence and them reprimanding soldiers for it. That's why I'm here. I'm no expert, but I'm going to find the experts so we can get resources to the military members who need them and the wives who do as well. Now, this podcast is not something that I've done with haste. I have calculated it all. I've actually thought over and over again, what if nobody listens? And then I always come back to, but what if they do? What if one woman or multiple women out there can find strength in hearing that they are not alone? What if they can find solace in me reiterating that no, you are not crazy. It's not you. It's not. Maybe they can find the strength to report their abuse or get out or perhaps preemptively even stop their husbands from spiraling into an abuser. So I'm going to be sharing stories of victims like myself, and I'm going to be sharing stories of those who did not survive and those who were impacted by that. And as I've said several times, I am not an expert in solutions, but I want to be solution-oriented, not just here complaining and venting. So I'm partnering with some of the brightest subject matter experts in the nation, even the world. I'll be chatting with clinical psychologists, Harvard professors, law firms who specialize in military divorce and law, and many more. Next time, I'm going to be talking about types of abuse, and I'm going to shed light on why physical abuse is not the most dangerous type of abuse always. And we'll also uncover other forms of abuse that many women and children are currently enduring. So thank you for joining me. Thank you for listening to this. And if you're not watching it on YouTube, please pop over to my YouTube channel. It'll be in the show notes. And tune in to me interviewing Dr. Shauna Springer. She's the nation's leading expert on PTSD in soldiers, suicide prevention, and the reintegration of warriors into society post-war. Please stay safe and don't lose hope. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you think this content would be helpful for someone you know, please share the link with them. Sources can be found in the show notes of today's episode.